It's Pet Care Day today on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and we're talking about dog park etiquette and other dog training issues today. And with us until 12:30 is George Malara. He's a professional dog trainer and the owner of Divine Canine in Madison. George has trained dogs for over 20 years. And then at 12:30, we get a little insight into what the job search website Indeed says is the best job of 2025, being a veterinarian. Dr. Calico Schmidt from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine will join us. But first, what questions do you have for George? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Welcome back, George.
Hey, Jill. Thanks for having me.
You bet. What a beautiful day.
So nice out.
Perfect day to go to the dog park.
That's right.
So are there a lot of dog parks in Wisconsin?
There are so many. And, mm-hmm. you know, coming from New York, I would have a lot of advice around dog parks, and I would say never ever go because they're the size of a postage stamp.
Sure.
And there were so many arguments. But when I moved here, I went to the dog park and I saw the acreage. It's not even by the yard, it's by the acre. You know, Capitol Springs, 22 acres of dog park. And my whistle changed. You know, so dog parks can still be a bit of a sticky place, mm-hmm. if you don't adhere to some really special rules that aren't necessarily posted at the park. They do a really nice job with signage and understanding a little bit about body language and certain things, but there's other things that we can talk about too.
Absolutely. Now, let's just make sure people understand there's a difference between a dog park and a park that lets you have dogs there.
Correct. A lot of like trails that they have, whether it's bird watching trails or you know, just little hiking trails, your dogs must be on leash. I personally don't care how good your dog is off leash. It's respectful to other people because there are some people that have reactive dogs that want to go for a walk with their dogs and they deserve to, that don't want other dogs to be off of leash. So it's really important to keep your dogs leashed up. Now, dog parks are an off-leash place. And in the words of Trish King, famous dog trainer, she says, dog parks are like a cocktail party where everybody's drunk. You can go and have a beautiful time or you can go and have a really rotten time. So the first thing I like to talk about is like understanding your dog. Like, does your dog enjoy the dog park? The dog park is not for everybody, people and dogs alike. So when we take our dogs to the dog park, are they engaging politely with other dogs? Are they giving chase? Are they playing politely? And understanding how your dog interacts with the dog park. So there are some dogs that don't necessarily like dogs, but they go to the dog park and they just go to sniff and hang out. And when dogs interact with them, they just ignore them and walk away. And that's wonderful. But then there are dogs that get approached and they might give corrections or give. And that's where you sort of have to ask yourself, is my dog really enjoying themselves at the dog park? I've worked with families where they have multiple dogs and I go, that dog and that dog go to the dog park. That dog does not go to the dog park because he doesn't enjoy it. And it's just perpetuating bad feelings around the dog park. But a couple of really standalone things about the dog park is one, clear the entrance. So what happens is the dogs that are arriving at the dog park, they're all high as a kite because they're at the dog park and they're charging up in the car. Rawr, rawr, they're barking and getting yes. all crazy. And then when they get to the park, they go in and then boom, they can get into an argument. So the dogs leaving the dog park are high as a kite because they were just at the dog park and they were running around with their friends and buddies and having a nice time. So what I tell people to do is when you come into the entrance, clear the entrance. Once you go into the park, get up and away from the entrance as quickly as possible. The second reason I want people to walk in away from the entrance is that sometimes people congregate and do the Wisconsin goodbye at the
goodbye
as they're leaving and yes. walking around the park. And then they finally get to the entrance. They hang out for a little while longer. And that can be a problem for dogs entering the park because all the dogs that are hanging out there all charge the fence to go say hello. Right. No yep. bad intentions. But mm-hmm. the dog that's being sniffed by 8 or 9 dogs yep. might not appreciate it. And then they might give a correction and then boom, you have a little argument. So clearing the entrance is important and also voicing it to the people that are there saying, hey, could you guys collect your dogs, please? My dog doesn't do well with multiple dogs greeting. And, you know, most people are very sweet and polite and they want to oblige and make sure everybody stays safe.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. Yeah. I go to the dog park in Jefferson mm-hmm. and it's fantastic, huge, four separate areas.
Wow.
And there's one for small dogs, there's medium dogs, there's big dogs. It's wonderful. But how do you decide if there isn't a park that has it for like small dogs or big dogs? To me, when I see people in the big dog park with little dogs, I get scared because big dogs could be, it doesn't take much with a little dog.
And really navigating that can be a little tricky. You know, that's why they make the small dog area, so that pound for pound, if the dogs do get into an argument, it's not going to be as severe versus the public, the large dog area, or Gen Pop, as I call it. Those dogs, like, if a larger dog corrects or corrects a smaller dog, it's just pound for pound, it could be more severe if the dog doesn't have bite inhibition or whatever. So I do like the separation of the little dogs from the big dogs. And if you have a little dog that does better with big dogs, that's great, but you have to make sure that the other dogs know. It's not always the big dogs that know that the little dog likes big dogs.
Right.
So you have to exercise caution. And I always tell people, err on the side of caution. I'd rather you be wrong than right.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I've seen little puppies, you know, with their owners are so excited. They're going to bring them to the dog park. And then these big dogs, they're playing, but they run right over the top of them, you know, back and forth. And that things can happen. So,
And exactly. Like when dogs get aroused, they get careless with their bodies. It's not that they're being aggressive. They're just being careless. And that's where accidents can happen. Because, again, pound for pound, a bigger dog, you know, clops over a little dog. It could hurt them.
Yes, absolutely. So what should we know about our dog before we decide to take them to a park?
So the other thing that you said that was spot on is that, you know, when people adopt a dog or purchase a dog, they want to go do all the social things first. And what I tell people to do is first you build a bond. You want to make sure you're connected with your dog, you're spending good time with your dog, and, you know, that you have a relationship, some basic obedience and manners, and then you venture to a dog park. And I also tell them, don't go at peak hours. Peak hours are generally between like 7 and 9, and again, 12 to 2, and then 4 to 7. That's when it's really, really busy. So I would tell people to go at the mall walker hour, right? When retirees, people that work from home, people bring their older dogs, and it's a little bit more calm and gentle at the park. That's the great time to go, just to sort of feel it out. And then you start sort of bleeding into the witching hour or the busier times at the dog park, and that's where you can sort of gauge out how your dog is doing.
We got an email from Sarah. She said that she's had much experience in various dog parks in Madison, and she says an unsupervised setting involving people and dogs is a recipe for trouble. It can be. I mean, we talk about dogs, but, I mean, people are a part of the equation also.
Absolutely right. And I remind all my clients that dog parks are a public space. And one of my favorite quotes is, never argue with a fool or a drunk, because people walking by won't know who the fool or the drunk is, right? So, you know, this person may have watched a whole two episodes of Cesar Millan
and
know everything about dogs. So the idea is that, you know, just go to the park, manage your dog. If you manage your dog, you should be okay.
Mm-hmm. What kind of commands should we have our dogs know before we go?
At the very least, name recognition, right? And a recall.
Mm-hmm.
And the recall needs to be sharp, meaning under distraction, because at the dog park, that's all that's there is distractions. You have all the little critters along the fence lines. You've got other dogs and people, and some people bring treats, and there's a lot of distractions. So having a super solid recall is key. The other thing I tell people to do, which just falls into just general dog training, people at the dog park will wait till their dog runs really far away. And then they're like, uh-oh, I got to call my dog. And then they call their dog, and the dog finally meanders over. If you flip that over and just start rewarding your dog for just checking in and being close, that's where they're going to hang out. They'll walk ahead and look back, and then you say, good dog. And then you call them over, give them some treats, and then, boom, you have a dog that's going to stay within that perimeter. They might be distracted from time to time and run off, but you start, you know, feed for what you like.
Good point. Now that brings up the, when other people are feeding their dogs treats or you're giving your dog, do you give something to the whole class or
great
do you
question.
Not?
You know, a lot of dogs suffer from allergies and food allergies, and I don't give dogs, as cute as they are. Mm-hmm. I try to get myself inoculated against cuteness twice a year because, you want to give all the dogs treats, but you don't know if they have some sort of issue with treats, and you don't want to send a dog home and give them a bellyache.
That's right. And they might follow you all over the park,
too. Right, the Pied Piper.
There's someone at my park who loves to feed the dogs, and I have a hard time getting my dog away from him, so I understand. So what do dogs need before they go as far as, like, vaccinations, licenses, all that type?
For vaccines, you just need their regular vaccines, the 3-in-1, the parvo distemper, and parvo distemper rabies. And then they need, I like for dogs to have the lepto shot. Leptospirosis is transmitted through urine and bacteria. The other thing I recommend is bringing your own water dish and water, because there's so much going on in the water bowls at the dog park. So when we had that, the canine flu a while back, like everybody picked up their water bowls, but then people fall back into the habit of just bringing water and adding it to the bowls there. So I tell people to bring their own bowls so that they can have a nice hygienic, clean drink of water and that you're not going to add to Giardia and anything else bad that they can get.
So when my dog goes and drinks out of the mud puddle, because that's what he does. Do I have to worry about that too?
And again, every dog's digestive tract's different.
Yeah.
You know, some dogs have cast iron stomachs and some dogs are very, very sensitive.
I love that. What about, some places have water, like they've got a river or a pond or something like that, or some parks have little pools for the dogs. Is that a safe thing to do? Or
if your dog enjoys it, they'll let you know if they want to go in there and play. Sometimes people are particular about how dirty their dogs get at the dog park. I always cringe when I see a beautifully manicured golden retriever and I'm like, you're crazy, your dog's gonna go lay in the mud. But you know, to each his own. But when it comes to like the water elements, in Madison particularly, we have all those algae blooms that happen, so making sure that the water your dog's swimming in is some sort of moving water. There's a beautiful park over here in Stoughton called Viking Park, and they have a little stream. Mm-hmm. Much safer, not totally safe, but much safer than the standing water of all the other lakes and stuff that we have in Madison.
Yeah, because the algae blooms can be deadly.
Deadly, deadly. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't take long for your dog to be thirsty, lap up a little bit of water, and they can get very, very sick. So,
yeah. For sure. Now, most parks require you to pay.
Correct.
And in order to get like this license, you can pay like for a trip, and then you can pay for yearly,
annual.
You have to have a dog license from your municipality.
Correct.
Too, right?
As dog well? License. And you have to look into it, because I know that the Dane County passes will cover some of the municipalities outside of Dane County that just sort of like, you know, they just sort of allow you to go to other dog parks. But yes, a daily or an annual. The annual is great. I love it because I'm giving back to the parks and I'm keeping the parks beautiful. Yeah, just those two, and then the vaccines are important.
Right, absolutely. Well, we're talking with professional dog trainer George Malara about dog park etiquette, but of course he can take all your other general training questions as well. So give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Coming up at 12:30, we're going to talk to Dr. Calico Schmidt from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine about what it takes to become a veterinarian. Right now, we're joined by George Malara from Divine Canine in Madison. If you've got any questions, we've got open lines. Apparently, we have a bunch of perfect dogs out there. 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send that email to talk@wpr.org. So getting back to the dog park, you'd mentioned earlier about taking water in a water bowl. What else should we bring along with us?
If you are doing some active training, you know, I don't object to people bringing dog treats to the dog park. I have been scowled at for having treats at the dog park. And, you know, part of it is like, well, I'm training my dogs. I'm training my clients' dogs. There needs to be reinforcement there. And for the most part, even if I start becoming the Pied Piper and the dogs are following me,
yes,
you know, I just ignore them. And eventually they give up and they go back to their humans. And it's not really that big of a deal. I am careful when I'm doling out food, even if I have my clients' dogs, my dogs, and a couple of other dogs. Everybody's really ramped up from running around and playing and sniffing, that when I deliver treats, I almost do something like a medieval bow where I'll have two treats and my arms will sort of extend to the side, so the dog's heads will point in opposite directions and deliver the treats. If I deliver one treat to one dog, the two or three dogs might go for it and then start a little argument. So by keeping their little heads separated, it can be really helpful in how we deliver our treats. Aside from treats, water, I do try to deter my clients. You know, people bring balls or frisbees to the dog park, and I find that the dogs that are really obsessed with fetching, they can sort of become a little bit territorial over their object. So I tend to tell people, like, you know, just go to the dog, let them sniff, let them just enjoy the park for what it is, because if they can't share, they shouldn't bring it to the dog park because it could cause a hazard.
Mm-hmm. And it's a good idea to bring a leash in with you just in case.
Yes, right? I do see. Great. That's a I see a lot when people go to the dog park, they take the leash and just drape it on the fence. And I always ask myself, I'm like, well, what if you need your dog on leash? So I tend to just drape it over my neck and sort of like a little bandolier.
Yep, that's what I do.
Bandolier, and I'm off to the races. This way, if I need to, if there's a dog argument, I can get my dog. I put her on leash. I let everybody deal with what's going on, and then I can let her off leash again, or just walk her away safely to let her off leash again.
Or if it's time to go and they don't want to.
Oh, well, that's a great one. I'm glad you brought it up. So earlier you asked, you know, what other commands or should your dogs know? Well, one of them is just a simple collar grab. I talk about this in all my training. With young dogs specifically, we have, if the only time their collar's being grabbed, the top three reasons are they're in trouble and it's time to leave the park. We can't clutch our pearls and go, oh, why is he running away? Right? It's time to go. So what we have to do is while you're at the park, you practice walking up to your dog, grabbing their collar, put them on leash, walk a few feet, let them off leash. And you just go through this a bunch of times. This way, when it's actually time to leave, they'll allow you to put their leash on and then they won't be running away saying, just 5 more minutes, Mom.
And don't forget to keep the leash on in the parking lot, too.
Correct.
I see that and my heart always goes in my throat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we've got some calls, so let's go to Jackie in Appleton. Go right ahead, Jackie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So our son is home from college and he brought his big dog with him, and we have a big dog, and they are learning how to play together. And a lot of times their play looks really rough to me, like they're kind of biting in each other's ears or kind of getting one of them down and standing over them. So I guess my question is, how much of that is play or how much of that is too aggressive? Should I try to break them up and separate them? We're just not sure. We don't want anybody to get hurt.
I love this question. So when two young, how old are the dogs?
One is under 1 year and the other one is 3 years old.
Perfect. So when you have two youngish dogs playing together, it looks a lot like the COVID spike, right? It just goes straight up to the sky. And what happens is as they get more aroused and it gets to that point where they're getting more and more rough, they get a little careless with their mouth, a little careless with their body, slamming into each other. And then at some point there's an argument. They get into a little scuffle. So what I do is I don't allow the spike to go all the way to the top. About 30 seconds to 2 minutes of play, depending on if they're playing nicely or not. If they're playing nicely, I let it go a little bit longer. If they're starting to get worked up, I'll interrupt sooner. But what I do is I hover directly over the dogs as they're playing, and I say, good dogs, right? Really loud and really boisterous and happy. And then they tend to look up at you, at which point you deliver, this is going to sound like a lot, about 30 treats in the span of 2 minutes.
Oh, wow.
Right? And they don't have to do anything. They're just eating the food. Food causes focus and calm. They'll actually physically slow down. Play causes drive and speed. So by feeding them, you're slowing them down. So at this point, we say, good dogs. And that sort of puts the brakes on. We feed. That slows them down. And then we say, okay, go play. And then they go back to playing. Now, they're not going to start where they were. They have to ramp back up. Now, the cool part about this is you have two different things that happen that are beautiful. One, auto check-ins. They'll be playing, and one of them will go, I think it's time for a treat. And they come out of play, and they come running. And I'll reward that. The second one is a secondary recall. All you have to do is say, good dogs, and they'll come running because that means food is about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to letting them play longer and longer. Now, in follow-up to your question, if you're ever not sure if the dogs are having fun, especially with your son's dog and your dog, what you do is you pull away what you believe to be the offending dog. So let's say your son's dog's being a bit of a turd and playing a little rough. You grab his collar and you pull him out of play, and you watch what your dog does. If your dog comes bounding back over to your son's dog and wants to play, let him have it. But if that other dog goes and gets a drink or lays down, or it could be indicative that he wasn't having too much fun. And it's just food for thought.
Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming that when you feed them those treats, you do two hands.
The medieval bow.
I have to remember that.
For thy fair maidens.
That's right. Thanks so much, Jackie. Good luck with that. Ellen and Madison, you're up next. Go right ahead.
I wanted to reinforce strongly not to give treats to a dog without checking with the owner. I have a dog with severe allergies, and someone gave her a treat, a very popular treat, thinking they were doing a favor, and she ended up in the hospital for 3 days.
Oh, geez. So,
yeah,
please
rough.
Don't give dogs treats.
I completely agree with you. The treat should only be doled out. And sometimes if I'm at the park and I'm not sure whose dog is who, I say, whose is this? Whose is this? Can they have a treat? And they'll say yes or thumbs up, thumbs down, and then I can give a treat or not.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what I've heard. Most people, they always ask.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So definitely. Thank you for that reminder, Ellen. If you've got a question or a comment, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can always send an email. That's talk@WPR.org. Next up, we got Deb in Cross Plains. Go ahead, Deb.
Hi, good morning. I was just on my way to run some errands, and I happened to catch your program about dog parks. And I just wanted to call in, and I can talk to you about my private dog park that my husband and I created about 7 years ago. It's outside of Madison off of Mineral Point Road. We turned an existing tree nursery into a 15-acre fenced private dog park. And we've been running it now for 7 years. And we had in the beginning thought we just would have a dog park with lots of dogs running around. Well, after having several people come out, word of mouth or through my advertising, I was approached by the woman that ran the Wisconsin Reactive Dog Support Group.
Oh, Kristen, that's my buddy.
Yeah, do you know her?
I moderate the Reactive Dog Facebook page.
Oh, do you really?
I do.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, she had a really anxious, fearful, reactive dog, and she wanted to know if she could rent our spot out for an hour to give her dog some some activity and some peace and quiet. So I kind of contemplated it. I talked to several people, dog trainers, and they said, you should go for it. There is nothing like this in this area. And we have a lot of dogs that can't be around other dogs.
Right. And that's, what you're doing is now a really, really hot commodity, because these private dog parks allow dogs that are reactive to run and romp and play, and it can help alleviate a lot of their symptoms around reactivity because their walks are so short, their ability to socialize, their ability to go out and sniff. I mean, you're providing a really wonderful service for dogs, because they even reactive dogs deserve time to go run and romp and play and enjoy the fresh air. Thank you so much for that, for your service.
Hey, Deb, how do you run that now so that people come out and they rent an hour of time? Or do you have other times where more than one dog is there? Or how does that work?
Yeah, well, it's evolved over the years. I actually saw a post on Facebook, 6-7 years ago, about a dog trainer. She actually doesn't work with the company anymore, but she sold it to two dog trainers. And she wanted to bring out clients' dogs, which she goes around and picks up all her clients' dogs for training and what they call pack training. And she needed a space in Dane County for the dogs. Well, at the time, we were just in the process of starting the park. We didn't have it fenced. So I said, if we can make some arrangements here, you can bring your dogs out. Well, unfortunately, it didn't quite work out as we all expected, because a couple of the dogs decided they didn't want to stay with her. So we just okay, we got to get this park fenced. And so we invited her to come back, and she brings the dogs out Monday through Friday. She now has two new owners. So they go around and pick up all the dogs, including ours. We call it the school bus. We call it school, and Teacher Kim, Teacher Jen. I'm giving a plug for Rough Trails, too. But and so they pick up all the dogs, and they take the dogs out. They are behavioral communicators, trainers, and pack. And they have been able to help these dogs adjust to other dogs, our environment, the peace and quiet, the ability to socialize, and all of that. And it's turned out really well. So
okay.
They're with us 5 days a week. And then I invite members that have, or people that have interest in the area, that are looking for a safe area, and a lot of times it was from Kristen. So I arrange a tour visit with the person and their dog. They have to bring their dog because I have learned through dog trainers kind of what to look for. And I give them a tour of our dog park because it's big and it's really not for every dog, especially really small dogs. But and so then I did a feel if they're going to be a fit for what we're looking for and the rules that we have to set up through Tahnee Cross Plains and Dane County. We have luckily had no issues or occurrences. So okay. If I approve the dog, they fill out an application, they have to sign a liability, and then they're allowed to book an appointment through me.
Okay.
And then through my open times,
sure.
And they can come and enjoy the park for an hour.
Okay, great. Thanks. Sounds good, Deb. Appreciate you giving us a call. Are there quite a few of those around these days?
There's so many, and they're really great. Like I said, really great for reactive dogs. It mm-hmm. gives them a place to run and romp, and they generally book 45-minute sessions, so there's no overlap even in the parking lot, so that you can safely get in the run and out of the run, so that there's like a little 15-minute overlap, and then those dogs get to run and play. And I know a lot of trainers that are utilizing those sniff spots for doing training. So, like, you set it up and you have the reactive dog in the distance. You bring in the other dog on leash and you can do a little bit of training. It's very, very, very good.
Nice. Okay. Well, let's go back to some emails. Sam emailed. She has a French bulldog who likes to army crawl across the floor. Sometimes he gets a light carpet burn on his belly, and she's wondering if she should be concerned about that. Should she put something on the belly when it gets red? Now, I know you're not a vet, but have you had this behavior before?
I've seen similar behaviors where the dog enjoys. So the first thing I would do is if the dog is actually itchy, it could be some sort of dermatitis, some sort of allergy. I'd probably like talk to the vet and see what's rug burn and if there's something else going on. In other situations I have seen, the dog is trying to satisfy themselves.
Uh-huh.
And we'll leave it there.
Okay.
Looking at the behavior, if he's causing even a little bit of harm to himself, I'd probably interrupt it. Just snap him at it. Hey, what are you doing, little guy? Come on, come over here. Just interrupt the behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe not give him access to the carpet so he can't play on the carpet.
That's so funny. Justin from Wapaka emailed. He recently lost his hound mix to lymphoma.
Oh.
He was 83 pounds, but very much an omega in the pack structure. He stopped going to the park because... I'm assuming Justin started going to the dog park because other dog owners were on guard with his large, energetic black dog in the mix of dogs, and he began to loathe the inevitable conversation. My dog is fine. He is a gentle giant. He will not even hurt your dog.
Yeah, and his question actually reminds me of something else that I'll talk about in a moment, but in these cases, like I said earlier, it's a public space. You know, even my beautiful dog, Dolly, she's a vocal player. She's a pity, always grumbling and vocalizing and barking.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there was a little golden retriever puppy. So I used Dolly to train puppies how to play. And this woman was terrified of Dolly's vocalization.
Oh.
And she's like, could you please? And I wasn't even going to give her the spiel. I'm a 25-year dog trainer. Like, mommy was scared and I'm going to support her.
Yeah.
And I'm going to let her come to her conclusions and answers. So I pull Dolly away.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sad because there could have been a great moment. But, you know, respectful to the owners and what they want for their dog.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have a dog that's rambunctious and playful, sometimes people get the wrong feel for it. I try to remind people, like, you want loose bodies when they're playing. You want sort of open mouth, sort of carefree, lots of leaping and bounding, nothing rigid or stiff. And one thing I tell people to do is when dogs are playing, if there happens to be a lot of vocalization, is to have the imaginary mute button, right? You mute it and you just watch their play. Is it soft, loose, and relaxed? Are they taking turns pinning each other? Are they taking turns chasing each other? Is there a lot of mirroring going on? Then the vocalization matters a little bit less.
Because some dogs are just more vocal than
sure.
others.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just okay. like people.
Yep, exactly. If you've got a question for George, give us a call, 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email, and that's talk@wpr.org. And we did get an email from Godfrey in Chippewa Falls. Her little fur daughter provides her portable water loves her portable water bottle and will only drink from hers. The best thing ever on walks or in public places. Portable water bottle.
Definitely.
Yes, I've seen those too. Those are great. So you said you were going to say something else. Go right ahead.
One of the things that I see a lot at dog parks is when people are introducing like adolescent dogs. So let's say you have a dog that hasn't been altered. And I'm really focusing this part of the conversation towards male dogs. So you have a young dog. And this is also a fun question. Jill, at what age do puppies stop being puppies?
I always figure a year.
4 months.
No.
For average breed, average 60
really?
Pound dog.
Wow.
4 to 5 months, they enter into adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
And they're adolescents until?
One.
Three.
I'm right? going to just keep saying one until I get it right.
And it's no surprise that in our shelters and rescues, mm-hmm. we have so many adolescent dogs because that's when they're growing the most mentally and socially. And that's why teenagers are difficult. And that's why teenage dogs can be difficult. With that said, When an unaltered male enters the dog park at around 4 or 5 months, in their body they have this huge testosterone surge, and that's there to create ligaments and tendons, right? All these hormones that need to be built. You're growing a dog, but what happens to other dogs is they sniff these puppies. They're still young dogs, and they go, "Whoa, your license to be a puppy's been revoked. You could be tried as an adult." So I talk about the kick me sign on these adolescent dogs, where they can be the sweetest, nicest dogs ever. And they go to the dog park, and because they smell a certain way, they get overcorrected by adult dogs. And there's that window that I won't take these young dogs to the park. So if I see a correction, I see another correction, I'm like, okay, we need to cut this out for a little while until your hormones regulate or until you're neutered.
Mm-hmm.
Because they can... that can really set the stage for what their behavior is going to be like. And we never want a dog to say, you know, the best defense is a good offense. That's how puppies would learn.
Sure. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
You see that a lot
with
dogs. Now, as far as like, you know, the neutering and spaying, whatever, does that really matter?
It does and it doesn't. You know, there are some dogs that don't do well with unneutered males and some that adore them. My Dolly, for example, has an affinity for unneutered males. She is, I don't know how to say it on the radio, but she is quite the harlot for unneutered males. We went to visit my sister. She has two unneutered males, and she was behaving so crazy and like, hey, big boy. And like, all,
oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So some dogs adore unneutered males, and then some absolutely abhor them. And you have to know your dog and what you're getting into. So I do say between certain ages, I wouldn't venture into the dog park, especially if you have a female in heat too. So if you have a female that's possibly going into heat, don't go to the dog park.
Don't go to the dog
park. Bad move.
It's a bad idea. Definitely bad idea for everybody
right.
involved. So if we are at the dog park and there is an actual fight going on, what is the best way to deal with that?
For the dogs that aren't involved in the argument, mm-hmm. collect your dogs, put them on leash, and stay away.
And
there's plenty of people that aren't holding a dog that can go help.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for the parties that their dogs are involved in the argument, stay away from the bitey bits, right? Don't
yes.
put your hands in the don't
right.
put your hands in the cogs that
right.
you're gonna get your fingers mashed
for
up.
Sure.
So,
for sure.
The best thing you can do is grab the dog by the hips or the waist. And you gently pinch around the withers there
uh-huh.
just to cause a little discomfort. Generally that dog will whip around and then you'll be able to grab the collar
and then pull them away.
And a safe spot to grab is the back of the collar. You know, there was a time where they sell bite sticks where you can like pry a dog's mouth open. And, I find that most of the dog park arguments are not with malicious intent. It's more like an argument from overexcitement, overplay, carelessness, and it's mostly smoke and mirrors.
Mm-hmm.
But when there is that really serious argument where the dogs are latched onto each other and really fighting, that's where you stay away from their mouths. Don't try to pry it open. There's no way you're going to pry it open. Grab the dog's collar, pinch at the waist. Sometimes you can even bend their tail just to cause a little discomfort so they turn around and let go of the other dog.
Uh-huh.
And then separate the dogs. It's very important that you sort of give each dog, it's a very hectic moment. So taking the time to just give the dogs the once over, communicate to the other owner, making sure that their dog's okay, exchange numbers if need be. for any veterinary costs or anything. It's the noble and nice thing to do is to, you know, share information and then move on. And understanding and diagnosing what went wrong is also very, very important because hindsight's 20/20.
Mm-hmm. I think as dog owners, we tend to blame the other dog.
Wouldn't be my dog,
no,
Jill.
No, my dog's perfect. I don't know what you're talking about. So that makes it a little more difficult, too. I mean, you get the people involved at that point.
Yeah, and people are ego-driven. And you know, like, there was a time when I was in New York City and I was at a dog park and I was with my friend. And he had this beautiful blue pit and all Buddha wanted to do is fetch with his lacrosse stick and just fetch, fetch, fetch. These two little Jack Russells were just harassing Buddha for at least 30 minutes. And then finally, Buddha just grabbed one by the harness and just tossed it.
Oh, my gosh.
And then the owner was there up at arms. And I go, well, your dog was harassing him for 30 minutes. He was being really tolerant. We asked you to grab your dog several times. Like,
yeah, you can only do so much, right?
Right.
Is it always a good idea then if that happens, just time for your dog to go home?
Yes, because it changes the – in smaller dog runs, it changes the whole – dynamic of what's going on. Everybody's sort of on edge and there's adrenaline and stress hormones pumping heavily. I recommend just either going for a nice separating yourself from the area or if need be, just leave the park. It'll be there tomorrow.
Okay. That's George Malara. He's our guest today on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Do you have a question or comment about dog parks or something your dog care about dog care or training in general? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk at WPR.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. Tomorrow it's Wildlife Wednesday, and we're going to talk about the state of Wisconsin fisheries with a panel of experts. And then we're also going to talk about land conservation trusts. So hope you can join us. That's starting tomorrow at 11. Right here, right now, we are talking about dog behavior. And we've got JJ in Appleton who has a question for us. Go ahead, JJ.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. We have a very submissive personality for our dog, and we have not had good experiences at dog parks where dogs have sensed that she's submissive and have come to attack her. I'm just wondering what we could do to increase her confidence so that if we were to introduce her to dog parks again, that she could come in with more of a presence, I guess.
Or just a little more confident. You know, some dogs, like I was saying earlier, just aren't meant for the dog park, and that's okay. Like, I'm sure she has a beautiful, sweet personality outside of being a little submissive. But in these cases, I ask people, well, does she have any, like, dog friends in your neighborhood that she does play nicely with?
Okay. All right.
Does she?
Yes.
Yeah. And so long as
because that, like you said, that's important too for them to get their energy out and be around other dogs.
Of course. And if she has her little core group of friends, you know, some dogs are a little submissive and a little bit more introverted, but they do really great with like three or four of their best dog buds. So you just have little play dates at each of their respective houses. And that's how she can maintain her social ability and stay happy with her friends, especially if they play super nice together. And then the other thing you could do if you really must take her to the dog park, I would say go to the dog park with some of her best friends so they can act as a buffer from the other dogs. But if you've seen a pattern of her being attacked for being submissive, I probably wouldn't expose her to that anymore, especially if she's got a nice tight group of friends.
Or maybe go at, like you said, off-peak a different
hours.
Time. Yeah, off peak. It makes a big difference when there's only one dog and when there's 10.
Yep.
Yeah. So good luck, JJ. Kristen in Madison, you're up next.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a puppy who turns 1 year next week. And one thing I've noticed about him is he likes to rush people and other dogs. And he's very playful. It's not really a threatening manner, but I can see how it could be threatening to someone or another dog that's not familiar with my dog. I'm wondering, how should I approach that? Is that something that I should train out of him? Or, you know, is that something that they grow out of? How should I approach a dog that rushes people, especially other and children, too?
Yeah, I call them close talkers with too much cologne. you know, they just really come in hot and heavy. You know, for some dogs, like, some dogs are more tolerant of that. It's really hit or miss. Like, it depends on who he approaches. But what you can do is work on, like, loose leash walking. And, like, if there's – how many people live in your household?
It's just me.
Okay. Recruit a friend or a family member, and you have them stand, like, you know, 30 feet away from you, and you give him treats as you're walking all the way up to your friend before they greet. If he goes to pull, you create distance. I call it penalty yard. So you walk away from the friend, and you sort of give him treats as he's walking nicely, and then at the last moment, you let him approach your friend. Remember that there's stages of this. So, like, there's the initial greeting when he finally gets there, and then there's the greeting on the way to the friend. So we want him walking nicely all the way up to a friend or dog that he knows and you trust. And then when he gets there, if he jumps up, your friend can walk away, or you can grab him gently by the collar and just pull him away, teaching him that when you jump, you don't get any more attention. But at the dog park, a lot of dogs tend to have the lack of manners when they're greeting other dogs. Is he making contact when he finally gets there, or does he stop at the last second?
He stops right at the last second, right in front of their face.
Yeah. I know a couple dogs like that. And really it's about, you know, rewarding him when he approaches a little bit slower. The thing at the dog park is that he's off leash, so he's going to get there before you. And it's tough to have him on leash. That's why I would practice these skills outside of the dog park, walking nicely to a goalpost. So it could be a pile of treats, it could be a toy, it could be a chewy, it could be a human, it could be a dog, but teaching him how to walk appropriately up to that thing that he wants.
Good luck, Kristen. That doesn't sound like fun.
It's not too bad.
No, telling a puppy not to do something is difficult.
But that's equivalent to, like, you know, imagine a 10-year-old kid shaking with their left hand.
Right.
It's a social deficit. It's nothing to be alarmed by.
Sure. Okay. Good. Easy for you to say. So we were talking about, you know, if, you know, your dogs get into a fight and whatever at the dog park, how much attention should you really be paying? Because so many people just use it for socialization of themselves, not just their dogs.
You know, it's the idea of just being, in general, being present, right? Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, you could snap a picture, but be in the moment. In the moment. When you're on your phone, you know, some people have the luxury of having an amazing dog that they can disconnect from. The dog is very well behaved, but those dogs are few and far between. We can't have our noses in our phones and then expect, you know, and then we look up, our dog got into an argument, like, what happened? That's irresponsible.
It definitely is irresponsible.
Yeah. So tuck your phone away. Maybe a quick picture here and there, but.
Oh, yeah. Lots of pictures.
Phones away.
Phones away. Yes. Thank you. And the other thing I was wondering about, too, is that there is a fight. A dog gets hurt. Is anybody liable, or once you walk into that dog park, it's your responsibility no matter what?
I don't know the law, Wisconsin laws. I know that in New York that dogs are viewed as property, so you just have to pay to, you know, fix the property. So paying for the vet visits, paying for whatever happened or went wrong. I don't know what the Wisconsin laws are.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are some people that sort of live in denial and, like, oh, my dog will be fine. And, like, they go to the dog park. It happened to me a couple days ago. I was with a client and this dog came over very playful, but overbearing. And then when my client's dog told him to stop, gave a little correction, he just came in harder. Mm. And I had to grab him. I put him on leash and I walked him over to his owner, made sure he had him on leash. And I asked him, I said, hey, could you wait till we're walked away before letting him go again? You know, just take control of the situation and be polite.
Mm-hmm. You're all dog lovers, so you got that in common. What kind of lasting effect can a bad dog park experience have on your dog's, you know, like, social development or long-term behavior?
It really boils down to the resiliency of the dog. Mm. You know, like, personalities, like people like me, I can brush a lot of stuff off and I'm pretty laid back. Whereas, you know, somebody else, if they get, you know, hollered at by their boss, they shut down and their week is ruined. It really has to do with the personality of the dog. There's dogs that are just bounce back from anything. And those dogs, we call them bomb proof, right? Like, mm-hmm. You could do anything. And then there are dogs that, you know, a dog growls at them and they shut down. So anything and everything in between. So really being a student of your dog's behavior and really knowing who they are. It's not about what you think they like. It's about knowing what they actually like and enjoy.
Mm-hmm. What about dogs that have disabilities, like, you know, they can't see, they can't hear, what have you? Is that a good place for a dog at the dog park?
I would do off peak hours, but there's something fascinating about dogs. The same way us as humans, we can identify somebody that has a visual impairment, not just by any assistance equipment, mm-hmm. We can identify if somebody, there's something not quite complete about them. Mm-hmm. And the same thing goes for our dogs. So I know clients that have visually impaired dogs where the dogs, new dogs walk up and they look and they sniff their eyes. They're like, there's something not right. And they tend to just go, okay, whatever. In some cases, that weakness can be a point of like an attack. Mm. So again, being careful and being thoughtful about, you know, when you go. And, you know, the other thing is you don't want a blind dog getting plowed into by another dog or walking into an area where the dogs are playing. So just being a little bit cautious, you know, an ounce of prevention can be worth a pound of cure.
I had a dog who was deaf from birth, and she never had a problem with the dog park at all. So, yeah, I guess it just depends. Know your dog, right?
Right.
When it comes to finding someone to help with training, like what you do, what tips do you have? Because obviously there's good and bad trainers out there.
Yeah, I always try to voice the idea of let the buyer beware. Do your homework. You know, two very, very simple questions you can ask a dog trainer to really identify what they do and how they do it is, what happens when my dog does something wrong? And what happens when my dog does something right? You can't dodge those questions.
Yeah.
They have to be transparent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we talk about e-collars or electric shock collars or whatever, or prong collars, you know, thinking about, you know, oh, well, it's just a gentle vibration. Then why do you need the electricity? Like, why do you need, like, ask the questions, be your dog's advocate, be thorough. You know, remember that you can interview many, many trainers. There's a ton out there. Unfortunately, there's no, you can get certified as a dog trainer, but you don't need to. Mm. And that's the danger, especially now with social media. A lot of people are just gathering a little bit of information, calling themselves dog trainers or imitating what they see these fly-by-night dog trainers do online, and it's dangerous.
Yeah, it sounds like
it's dangerous.
For sure. It looks like Jeff's been doing a little research for us, and he said that the Dane County Parks website says that dog owners are legally and financially liable for injuries and damages caused by their dogs, and it's a state, Wisconsin statute. But how do you know who causes what? If it's two dogs fighting,
right.
It sounds like it could be, you know, kind of nasty. So
speculation, Your Honor.
That's right. That's right. I can see all the witnesses coming in. Watch those Dobermans. They don't.
That poodle's a damn liar.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Let's see. What else haven't we talked about with dog park? Is there anything else that we haven't covered, George?
You know, I think there's some husbandry stuff that we could talk about, you know, the idea of like, you know, what happens after the dog park, right? If you have a dog that has trouble being handled at home, going to a muddy dog park might not be a good idea to start, right? Working on husbandry and handling, making sure that your pup is comfortable being touched and handled in different ways. I always talk about husbandry being so, so, so important, because imagine your dog's running around at the dog park and they start limping. Guess which foot you have to touch, right? So the idea of handling your dog's feet and being there and, you know, handling them in many other places so that, God forbid, something happens, you have to be able to touch them.
Sure, absolutely. I can't hear myself. There we go. Okay, sorry, folks. Just want to make sure I was broadcasting out there. I think that's so important, is that you need to know your dog.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And get those basic obedience calls down.
Yep.
Is it a good idea to take obedience classes?
Absolutely. And okay. I think that was one of the other topics we're going to talk about today.
Mm-hmm.
One thing what happens a lot of times, and I think dog classes have their place, but I really think that you should do some training prior to the class, because in the class, there's going to be other dogs and you're going to be wrangling your own puppy and you're not going to be able to hear the other dog, the instructor,
sure,
and all that stuff. So,
well, we'll cover that when we come back. We're going to take a little bit of break. We're
beautiful.
Talking with George Malara about dog behavior and how to make sure that your pet does the best job they can. And you too. We'll be right back. Well, that music must mean it's Pet Care Day on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and we're talking about dog park etiquette and other dog training issues today. And with us until 12:30 is George Malara. He's a professional dog trainer and the owner of Divine Canine in Madison. And George has trained dogs for over 20 years, and he's so young looking, so he must have started when he was five. At 12:30, we're going to get a little insight into what the job search website Indeed says is the best job of 2025, being a veterinarian. Dr. Calico Schmidt from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine will join us. But right now, what questions do you have for George? We have a couple of lines open, so give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email. That's talk@wpr.org. So let's go right to the phones, George. We've got Steve in Madison with a question. Go ahead, Steve.
Oh, I have a question and a few comments. First of all, my dog, we got a dog 2 years ago, wonderful dog, sweet dog. She loves people. She loves other dogs. I had to go from going to a big dog park to a smaller dog park because she did not respond to commands to come. She's very food-oriented, so strangers would give her treats. I read up and it said, oh, you should take your dog to a smaller dog park. And that helps. She's a foxhound, and that's what they're known for. She was attacked by a different dog, and I took her out for longer walks, and the more she got exercise, she was back more to be herself. But she has a great memory, and she knows which dogs to avoid. So she has a goes up on a picnic table to avoid other dogs, and now she started growling up. And other dogs. So I take her out. I took her back to a bigger dog park, and she does fine in a bigger environment. So that's my experience with my dog. I guess the biggest trouble I've had is still the same thing. People think it's, a petting zoo and want to give my dog treats without asking me. And if that's happened to other people whose dogs have allergies, and it's basically because she's not a retriever, she'll follow whoever has the best treat.
Was that a question, Steve? Or?
Yeah. Oh, we're here.
Yeah, well, I said, please do not give my dog treats to a person. And she said, I'm going to call the cops. To me, that's like hitting below the belt. What can I do to get, I'm noticed, like, don't give treats to dogs. You wouldn't give dogs treats. You won't give kids treats to people you didn't know, but that still happens. So, and it's an innocent thing.
Yeah.
But if a dog, then it takes my joy away. Right. And I like to see my dog happy.
Yeah.
You know, and it's completely innocent, but hey.
So I love what you were doing by taking your pup. What's your dog's name?
Penny.
Penny. I love that you're taking her to a smaller dog run. The smaller dog run just makes it more, you're managing her space so she can't rehearse the bad behavior of running too far ahead and shaking people down. I call it stop and frisk, you know, stopping people for treats in the park. So whenever somebody has an issue like this, I always say, well, what do you want your dog to do? Stay closer to you so you can manage her, right? So in the house and in your yard, what you can do is start working on a little bit of recall. So anytime she's away from you, you say her name, Penny. And then when she looks at you, say, good girl, like invite her to come over. When she gets to you, this is vital, grab her collar. We want to make sure we have possession. And then give her a handful of treats, 3 or 4 treats, and make sure they're super high value. We want to make sure you're carrying the better treats so that she wants to stay closer to you at the park and not venture out. Even though, you know, Debbie up ahead has milk bones, you're going to have chicken, cheese, turkey, roast beef, hot dogs. So she'd be a fool to go ahead to go visit with Debbie. So you do the training at home and in your yard first to create reliability and a good foundation and fluency of the behavior so that she comes when called when you say her name. And then you go to the little dog park and then you practice calling her there a bunch of times. So she's sniffing the ground, you walk away, you call her. And then after you've warmed her up a little bit, then you head into the bigger portion of the park. You can also put her on a 25-foot leash, like a long static line, not a retractable. Retractable leashes are the devil. You want to put her on a nice long line. And then this way she can only get that far from you. So when she hits the end of the line, she might look at you. And then you say, good girl. And you call her over. She comes over to you, give her a bunch of treats. And then you can maybe start letting the leash drag And if the moment she decides to start taking off, you pick up the leash and you reel her in a little bit. But it's about being consistent about you rewarding her when she's close, you rewarding her for all the yes behaviors that we want her to have.
Okay. Thanks, Steve, for that question. Jean emailed. She's looking for help with a fixed dog who likes to jump on the backs of other dogs at the dog park. Any ideas would be helpful. The dog is a pit mix.
Yeah. So mounting behavior is a very interesting one. As humans, we're very naughty and we think sex, right? But it's not sex. For dogs, a female would have to be in heat for them to want to procreate. Whereas humping at the dog park is generally a play behavior, and the dog is using it as a tool. So sometimes it's a social deficit, like they're so excited, they don't know what to do. I'm just going to hump. But then sometimes what dogs will do is they hump because of the reaction they get. The dogs will chase and they're like, ha ha, they run away and the dogs chase and they're like, I got rewarded for. And this is the thing about behaviors, that even though nobody's giving that dog a treat for humping, he's being rewarded. So if you want the humping to stop, because you're correct, if he does hump the wrong dog, he could get corrected. It could, you know, an argument could ensue. So what I would recommend you do is the moment he humps, you walk over, grab his collar, put him on leash, and then he gets to not be off leash for a little bit. And then try it again afterwards. Now, if he engages in any appropriate play, a play bow, even if he pokes his muzzle into the other dog's neck a little bit, just to asking politely for play, if he does that, then I would go ahead and say, good boy, buddy, and give him a couple of treats.
Okay, that sounds like a great solution. Nancy in Brookfield, go right ahead. You're next.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question about an 11-month-old golden doodle who is kind of timid and shy. But yesterday, someone came over with a toddler, and the dog growled and barked the entire time. She has growled at other things, but seems to kind of let it go if you reassure her, like at the groomer. But we're very concerned about this behavior, and we're not quite sure what to do about it.
So something I'd have you look up online is something called fear periods in dogs. Dogs, especially the larger breeds, can go through two fear periods, one at around 5 months and then another at around 10, 11 months. But it can happen at any moment. And this is a genetic code that keeps the dog safe and alive. The idea of dogs and animals and anything on the planet is to procreate and make more. But if they were to walk, think back to caveman days, there's a young dog and he goes, oh, look, a kitty. I'm like, yeah, that's a saber-toothed cat. It's going to eat you, right? So
true.
So to keep their DNA alive, they start to have this sort of unwarranted fear of novel things. It would be a bag in a tree or somebody moving a wheelbarrow, because they have to stay safe. So you see this fear page. So the best thing you can do in these moments, especially if they're showing signs of fear or growling, is to pair the scary thing with food, even the toddler. And the follow-up question people generally ask is say, well, George, aren't I rewarding the growling? No, you're feeding your dog because the toddler exists. You're feeding the dog because the landscaper exists. And what happens, you go, oh, every time I see a landscaper, my mom gets real generous with the snacks. This is good. I like landscapers. I hope we see more. I hope we see kids, because mom gets really generous with the cheese when kids are around. Kids must be okay. Instead of what we normally do, the knee-jerk reaction for most dog owners is to correct.
Yeah.
Right? Dog growls at a child? No. We jerk the leash. We say, no, knock it off. Then what's the dog going to say? Whoa, I thought I didn't like kids, but you fly off the handle when there's kids around. That's not safe. Oh,
that's so true. We always forget to look at it from the dog's point of
right.
view, don't we?
And that's what I try to teach people, is like, look at it from their perspective.
Yeah.
That little piece of modern art, welded stuff in the yard, that's very scary.
Yes. And that little shrub that's right by my driveway, it definitely looks like a good place to mark. thank you, Nancy. Appreciate that call. Amy emailed. Her mother has a mini Australian golden doodle. That sounds like an interesting combination. And he has shown food aggression, possessiveness, and has now bit 3 times. What is the best next stop for her to take aside from ensuring that the dog is crated whenever visitors are around?
Ooh. you know, when it comes to resource guarding, there's a lot of moving parts. You know, the laundry list goes like this. Number one, how much warning does the dog give, right? So if I approach the dog and he freezes and he grumbles and growls, that's a great warning. Thank you for letting me know you're uncomfortable, right? I tip my hat and say thanks. What people generally do, this is going back to what I just said, right? The dog is guarding their food and they punish the dog for growling. The dog says, got it. I won't growl. I'll just bite. And then I get the call that says, my dog bit me out of the blue.
Uh-huh.
You took the airbags out of the car, right? I want all the safety devices, right? And that's the culture clash that humans have with dogs. It's like we misinterpret what they're doing and we want that to stop, but we don't look at what else is happening inside the dog. So when it comes to resource guarding, understanding that it's not a dominance-based aggression, it's a fear-based. It's fear-based, the fear of having something taken away. The questions to ask, well, I would definitely have you find a good dog trainer. You can go to the APDT website, Association of Pet Dog Trainers. They have certified trainers on their site. They're all certified and they promise not to use aversives. Then once you have a trainer on board, they'll be able to walk you through this. We don't want to use punishment around the growling. And then you also have to decide and figure out what does he guard. Most dogs will guard edible things. Their dog dish, bones, chewies, certain things. Some dogs will guard balls and toys. And then some dogs will guard other things that are really novel. Q-tips or underwear or socks. But the idea is to understand what your dog is guarding. And then we do exchanges. So generally with food bowl, right? Jill, what kind of car do you drive?
A Honda CRZ.
Okay. So imagine if I said, hey, Jill, can I borrow your car? You're like, it's George. He's on the radio with us and he's a nice guy. He doesn't smell like whiskey at 8 a.m. Great. You let me borrow your car. I return the car and it looks like I had 20 muddy dogs in the back and there's coffee cups. Nothing physically wrong with the car. And an empty gas tank. I return your car to you. Hey, Jill, can I borrow your car again?
No.
But let's say I borrow your car and I return it detailed inside now with a little tree hanging from the rear view and a full tank of gas.
Oh, for sure.
Anytime. So when we take our dog's dog dish, we put cheese on top of the food and we give it back. Whatever I take away, I return better than when I took it. And you start working the dog from where they are. Mm-hmm. So some dogs, I have to start with an empty food dish because they'll guard food, any food. We just do add-ins on the kibble, and then we add kibble and cheese, and then we add other stuff. We keep on doing these exchanges until the dog feels comfortable with relinquishing it because I'm going to return it better than I took it.
Mm-hmm. So now, will they then be okay with you taking the food, but when another dog comes around, is that going to transfer?
And that's a totally different ball of wax.
Okay.
So resource guarding from humans, I treat differently than resource guarding from dogs. Mm-hmm. You know, with dogs, it's difficult because you can't say, move a little closer. Like, it's too many moving parts. You can have a dog on leash. We feed for, but management tends to be so much easier. You know, feed everybody in crates. Mischief managed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that totally makes sense. Jay emailed, their dog is social when he's off his leash, but very reactive on his leash. He's 3, a golden retriever, and has been neutered. How can Jay change the reactive behavior?
Excellent. Did he say how old the dog is?
3.
3. So this is really great because when people call me and they say, my dog is aggressive, and I say, well, tell me a little bit about it. I don't want to lead them to an answer. I want to sort of figure it out. So my first question is, does your reactive dog go to dog parks or have dog friends? Oh, loves the dog run. I know it's not aggression. I know it's frustration.
Okay.
Leash-induced frustration or barrier frustration. You see a lot of fences too. So once I know that, then I know, one, that if, God forbid, something happened and we had a whoopsie moment, dropped the leash or whatever, we know that the dog is not going to go put holes in another dog.
Mm-hmm.
We know that it's going to be a little bit more subdued. So that's really wonderful. So what we do is every time you go for a walk, you have your treat pouch full of super yummy stuff, chicken, cheese, turkey, roast beef, hot dogs. And this is the ticket. This is the most important part of this. You wait until your dog sees the other dog. So what happens normally is I'm walking down the street with my reactive dog. I see a dog coming in and I do one of three things. I wind up on the leash in preparation for the lunging and barking. I nervously talk to my dog. Okay, be a good boy. You can do it. And 3, I use food as a distraction. Don't look over there. Go over here. Look over here. And then eventually my dog goes, it's funny. Anytime you wind up on the leash, pull out food, or talk to me, a dog appears. So you are classically conditioning. You're right. Just conditioning the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. So what we do instead is we wait for our dog to see the dog. We're bopping along. I see the dog. Don't do anything. And then finally my dog locks in on that dog. And I go, oh, do you see the puppy? What a good boy. And I feed him, feed him, feed him, feed him. And this is the part where people look at me like I have 12 heads. They go, wait a second, George. You want me to feed my dog when it's barking and lunging? And I go, yep. You're not feeding him because he's barking and lunging. You're feeding him because that dog exists. Mm-hmm. So what ends up happening is that if we pair this correctly, you're out for a walk, your dog sees a dog, and there's a history of reinforcement. Your dog's going to see the dog and go, dog cookie, and look at you, and then go, pay up, I found another one. And then we pay. And then the barking subsides. We teach them how to be a little bit more neutral and relaxed instead of getting all worked up. Mm-hmm. Because even these dogs that love being social, when you allow them to come in like a close talker with too much cologne, it's the recipe for an argument. The other dog's like, whoa, 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 get out of my face. And then they get into an argument.
I can see those as titles of the chapters in your dog training book.
Ah, close talker, too much cologne.
Yep, I think that's got to be written.
That's a good one.
Elaine from Toma called. She couldn't stay with us, but she wants to know what she should look for when buying a puppy other than cuteness.
You know, one of the services that I provide, and a lot of trainers could provide this service, is the dog shopper, meaning when I have families that are like, we're thinking about adopting a dog. They're very few and far between because people are very impulsive. And they say, I want that one, right? Whether you're purchasing a puppy, breeding has its own special place, or adopting a dog from a rescue, you can hire a trainer to go meet the dogs with you to get a better idea. Like, I am not a mechanic, Jill, and I want a mechanic to go kick the tires before I buy a used car.
Right.
So same thing for a trainer. They'll be able to get insight and look at the dog for who the dog is. And with puppies, it's not going to be conducive to what they are as adults, but there's still a lot to be said about how puppies behave. So hiring a trainer, would be the best guide for you to sort of guide you through that, because there's too much about behavior that I could say, oh, make sure its ears are pricked. No, obviously the ears are fine. But you know what I'm saying? Like,
sure.
Got to make sure you have somebody with you that can take you through it. Obviously, some of the obvious ones are, if you're sitting down, all the puppies should come to you and want to be next to you. I would stay away from the more shy puppies. I would also stay away from the dogs that are jumping up and trying to bite your chin, right? Find something in the middle, somebody that wants to engage. And I just have a propensity to adopt female dogs. I like girls.
And I like the male dogs.
Yeah.
So I guess
everybody's got their preference.
when it comes to that, should you yourself know what kind of dog you want? Because obviously not everybody wants a dog that, you know, chases things.
Right. And so, but people tend to get dogs based on aesthetics. I like how that dog looks. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, a Jack Russell in an apartment is not a good dog.
No.
If you live in a small space, I tend to want you to get a big dog. They're going to need a couple of walks a day and then plop on the couch and they'll be more mellow.
Yeah.
As opposed to these little guys that are just, and terriers in general, terra, where does that word come from?
Ground.
Earth.
Yeah.
Right? So these dogs are ratters. They're meant to be thrown on a ship and disconnect from humans and just go terminate rats. Mm-hmm. And they're like, my dog doesn't have a connection with me. Why not?
Yeah.
Because they're independent.
Yeah. And dogs shed, FYI.
That's true.
You know, and then when they eat, they get stuff all over.
Right.
And you got to be prepared for that before
all
you,
the
before
dog
you
things.
In. Dennis in Two Rivers emailed. He stresses that dog owners need to attend obedience classes with their dogs. And Jeff asks if that is even an option to drop. I'm sure where Jeff came in. Jeff, our producer.
Oh.
Okay. He asks if that's even an option to drop your dog off for obedience classes.
You know, as trainers, we have to be on the cutting edge and also offer services that we can that are beneficial, that don't take away stuff. So my company personally, I will do board and trains only if you've done privates with me, because I, at the end of the day, want you to know how to train your dog.
Mm-hmm.
Could I train a dog? Absolutely. But I want you to know how to do it and then maintain what we've done together.
Right.
There are some places, and be very careful with board and trains. You know, find out. Remember what we said. What happens if my dog does something wrong? What happens if my dog does something right? Because some of these board and trains, they use shock collars and they don't tell people and they use aversives that, you know, they're doing it behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be aware of that and ask those questions. But I recommend working with a trainer privately first. Build up some chops, relationship, some basic obedience and manners under distractions, and then go take a basic group class. that's gonna be their black belt test, because then they have to perform the things that they've already learned in a group setting with distractions. But you've already prepped them for that.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe start taking specialty classes. You know, there's a local dog trainer does parkour with classes and other trainers. And every trainer loves what they do. Like, some trainers love small dogs, some trainers. And go find the trainer that's going to suit you and your pup and the hobbies you want to keep with your dog.
Sure.
Scent training and lure coursing and competitive obedience. There's dozens and dozens of games you can play with your dogs.
Absolutely. We were mentioning earlier, or we didn't mention, we were chatting during the break about your dog park safari.
Oh,
tell us
yes.
about that. That sounds like so much fun.
I have to do another one where, you know, in talking about dog body language and dog behavior, one of the classes that I do is we go to the dog park as a group, but nobody brings dogs except for me. And then I give them sort of like the David Attenborough approach, where I give them the color commentary of each behavior that the dogs are doing and watching the dogs play. And I describe the dogs so that they're just taking it in. They don't have to worry about their dogs. And then we do another class when they bring their dogs, and then we sort of navigate, and then they flex all this cool stuff they learned from the safari.
That sounds like so much
fun. So much fun.
Yeah.
I love it.
I think, you know, we're going to send Larry to that with you, and we're going to videotape that for everybody to watch. I think that would be fun. So I'm his boss. I can make him, right?
That's right.
Well, George, thank you once again for sharing so much
information. I love
coming
here.
I
love
us.
Hanging out with you guys. You guys are fantastic.
Well, we
thank
really
you for having me again.
It. You bet. George Malara has been with us. He's a professional dog trainer and owner of Divine Canine in Madison. Coming up, we're going to visit with Dr. Calico Schmidt about the joys and struggles of being a veterinarian. Please stay with us. Well, these days when you go over to a friend's house, you're more likely to trip over squeaky toys, chew bones, and treat balls than you are to step on Legos or crayons. And that's because more American households have pets now than they have children. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. And who's taking care of all these pets when they get sick? Well, veterinarians, of course. Demand for veterinarians is growing faster than a golden retriever puppy. And that's one of the reasons the job site Indeed recently named being a veterinarian as the best job for 2025. But is checking dogs and cats for fleas and ticks really the ticket to a fulfilling career? Well, we're going to find out. Our guest is Dr. Calico Schmidt. She is a doctor of veterinary medicine with the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, and she ran a small animal practice for 24 years. What do you want to know about being a veterinarian? Join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. Schmidt, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here today, and hopefully we'll represent well all of the veterinarians out there.
There's a lot of them, but probably not enough, right?
Yeah, it's a growing need, I think, and certainly all of our students at the veterinary school have not had trouble finding a job because there's so much need for veterinarians across
definitely.
The U.S.
And across the board, too, from little to big animal.
Yes, definitely mm-hmm. so, especially in rural practice. There's
yes.
definitely been a need for large animal veterinarians, too.
Yeah, because it's not an easy job, especially when big animals. I mean, because big
Indeed.
Animals are big animals.
So. It requires a whole different set of muscles and skills, definitely.
Yeah, muscles, I think, is key. So I think what we need to do is have people read, you know, James Herriot books,
yes.
and then they'll want to become a veterinarian.
Yes.
Maybe not. Right?
I loved those when I was little, too, and certainly that contributed to my wanting to be a veterinarian as well.
Yeah, I did, too. I think that they're so much fun. So I guess before we start with, well, my producer wanted me to ask you about your name. So Calico, of course, is a type of cat.
Indeed.
Did that make you want to become a veterinarian?
You know, it's a really good question. I love cats. And interestingly, my dad is not a huge cat fan. At least he wasn't when I was little. But my dad is an interior decorator, and my mom went to school in textiles. And so
sure.
They named me after the fabric.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I've definitely had people ask me, did you change your name because you're a veterinarian and you love cats? And nope. I think it was just meant to be.
I think that's hilarious. Yes, I changed my name to match my profession.
Yes.
That happens all the time.
Of course.
Okay, so what type of education do you need to pursue to become a veterinarian? I mean, how do you even start, like, in high school? What should you be focusing in on?
That's a great question. And, of course, a focus for veterinary medicine is science. So if you're a high school person interested in becoming a veterinarian, taking all of the science courses that you can will be really helpful. One thing that our admissions team really looks at is grades. So really studying hard and doing your best grade-wise is really helpful, whether it be in high school or college leading up to veterinary school. The other thing that I think is really helpful that our admissions committee also looks at is animal experience and just broad experiences, not even all having to do with animals. So get some experience with small animals, dogs and cats, with large animals. Go volunteer at a dairy farm or take care of horses or learn to train or ride horses. All of those things will show that you're a well-rounded individual with a great interest in animals.
And I'm sure lots of people out there would love to have someone volunteer to clean out their stalls and their horse yes, barn too.
Indeed. Right? Anything like that is helpful.
Well, being around animals really, really, I mean, it's good for everybody. I think unless, of course, there's unfortunate allergies involved.
Yes.
But so volunteering, humane societies, that
yes.
type of thing.
Humane societies always need help. Mm-hmm. A lot of humane societies and animal rescues are now fostering lots of different animals. So
true.
Foster pets in your own home. Mm-hmm. Take courses. Help with training courses for animals. Any experience you can get is wonderful.
Yeah. And reading, I would assume?
Yes, reading about animals. Anything
yeah.
you can do.
Yeah, 4-H is a good place too, right?
Oh, beautiful. Yes, 4-H, mm-hmm. a lot of our students end up having some experience in 4-H or FFA, which is Future mm-hmm. Farmers of America. We have a number of students who've grown up on dairy farms or helped with dairy farms, especially in Wisconsin.
Okay, so you're doing all this when you're in high school. What do you do then? Because you don't go to veterinary school right away. You still have to get your undergraduate degree.
Correct.
So what areas do you focus on? Is there a specific degree for people that want to go on to veterinary school?
That's a really cool thing about veterinary medicine is there's not really a specific major that you need in order to apply to veterinary school. So you can major in anything that you wish to as long as you complete all of the prerequisite courses, which, as you'd imagine, are mostly in the sciences, and communication as well is important. Having some basic chemistry and anatomy and physiology, all of those are really good things. So we have people who have majored in communication and in finance and you name it, as long as you get all those prerequisites in, you're a good candidate for veterinary school.
Oh, that's great. Now, is there a test you take, like an LSAT you take for law school? Is there?
There used to be.
Okay.
So we used to have a graduate school admissions test that people took. Our school is no longer requiring that because
okay.
we found that it kind of overlooked some students who weren't able to take that test. So the application process is basically an application form that one fills in where you share all of your educational experience and the grades that you received. You share all of your animal experiences, and then we get thousands of applicants and have to narrow those down to 100 students per class.
Oh, 100.
That's the hard part.
Oh, my gosh. And there aren't a lot of veterinary schools in the state, right?
Correct. There's a growing number. We now have some additional schools who have opened up, but I think at last count we have about 27 veterinary schools in the U.S., so not every state has one.
No.
And it's a bit of a competitive process, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine that. Now, what about schools outside of the United States? I know that can happen with medical degrees. Does that happen with being a veterinarian?
Absolutely. So there are schools in other countries around the world. The difficult part there is if one graduates from a school in another country, for most of those students, when they come to the United States, if you're interested in practicing here, you have to take a special veterinary licensing exam, since not all schools are the same.
Oh, sure.
They just want to make sure everyone has the knowledge and skills to successfully be a veterinarian in the U.S.
Does your license cover, like, the state you're in? If you move to another state, do you have to get that license also?
That's a great question as well. So once we graduate from veterinary school, we take a veterinary licensing exam that's a national exam. So that's required for anyone who practices in the U.S. And then individual states also have their own specific requirements. So to practice in Wisconsin, for example, when I graduated, I took a test just to make sure that I knew all of the veterinary regulations and rules pertaining to Wisconsin.
Oh, sure.
And different states have varying requirements, but they're fairly similar. there.
Okay. And of course, they probably change a lot too. So you have
they
to keep
do.
Up with everything.
Indeed.
It's not just the medical stuff. You have to keep up with the other stuff too.
The paperwork, yes.
What is it like when you're one in one of those 100 people? What does your studying look like? What does your day look like?
That's changing a little bit, at least at the UW-Madison's Veterinary School. So when I was in school and up until this year, much of a student's day involves being right at the veterinary school, attending lecture courses, and then there are labs and activities that we complete as well for the first 3 years. We are right now undergoing a huge curriculum revision in which students will be doing a little bit more self-directed learning, where they'll perhaps be watching lectures on videotape, and then they'll come to school, and we really want to get them active using the knowledge that they've studied on their own. So that will occur during the first 3 years for students, and then during the final fourth year, all students complete a series of clinical rotations, which right now are a series of two-week rotations where they may be with our primary care general practitioners for 2 weeks. They spend time in the large animal hospital, the small animal hospital. They can go off to other hospitals if they have particular interests, maybe with zoos or wildlife or research. So they can sort of craft their own experience the fourth year, while there are certain rotations that are required of everybody.
Sure. That makes sense to get that general, the basics down. Now, the job site Indeed ranked veterinarian as the best job of 2025. Did you know about that until we contacted you?
I didn't. Okay. I was a little bit surprised, although excited
yeah.
to hear that. Yeah.
So why do you think that becoming a veterinarian is a smart career choice? Let's do the pros.
The pros first.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great question. I think one of the things that anyone might imagine is, I think for someone who loves animals, it allows you to work with those things that you love every day of your life, which is really fun. And I think an unexpected part, at least for me, was just finding the joy of working with the people who come along attached to those animals. I think some research has shown that many people who go into veterinary medicine are a little bit introverted, and we like being in the quiet and with our animals. However, just talking with the people that come along with those animals is a joy. And for me, that's part of my social network, is the people that I've gotten to know as clients who come with their animals. So those are really some of the joys, just working with the animals, working with their people. Our day is often filled with a lot of variety, so we could be seeing a new puppy or kitten for a wellness visit and vaccinations in one appointment, and then for our next appointment, we may be seeing a senior animal who's very ill, and we need to help find out what's wrong and make a diagnosis and help with treatment.
Sure. And I think that's a lot of what people maybe don't think about ahead. It's like you do have to deal with the sad, hard parts of it, too. And, you know, like I said, I was surprised about the best job because I had heard these reports on the mental health issues that the veterinarian community has had. So what are those cons?
That's a really good question as well, because I think part of my surprise in hearing why veterinary medicine was ranked as a top job is that there's also been quite a bit of publicity that working as a veterinarian makes one at risk maybe 2 to 4 times more likely to die by suicide versus people who are members of the general public. And I think that's because of perhaps some of the stressors of the job. And I think for many veterinarians, one hard thing is that we're not perfect. We can't cure every single disease that's out there while we want to. And of course, that's why we get into this profession. We want animals to be happy and healthy. So I think that's one difficulty. I think another is that many people who become veterinarians, you know, for us, that's part of our identity. And so it becomes very difficult to separate work from home life, and that work-life balance is really difficult. So many veterinarians bring their work home with them. For our students, we're trying really, really hard to help them understand that there's a difference between work and home. And in order to be able to help our animals and their people, we need to be healthy too, or we can't help. So mental health has become really, really important.
Yeah, I was going to ask that, how you prepare your students for that, because it is rough, and you're treating an animal who can't tell you where it hurts, right? And that makes it really difficult to diagnose. So that's hard. How's the reaction been when you talk about these things to the students?
I think students are all, you know, they're very smart, intelligent people, and that's how they get to where they are. Mm-hmm. So I think many of them, especially because they've spent time shadowing other veterinarians or working at shelters, they really do understand that there are some difficulties and hardships they're going to have to face. So I think they come to it with a very realistic view of things. We're trying very hard to help foster those professional skills for them that allow them to build mental health for themselves, understand when they're experiencing anxiety and stressors, and helping them to find ways to work through that so they can be happy and healthy and really serve the animals and their people best.
Sure. Is that also happening in the profession for those who are already veterinarians?
Yes, okay, indeed. There have been a number of studies looking into veterinary well-being and ways that we can foster that for veterinarians who are in practice.
Wonderful. Dr. Calico Schmidt is our guest today. She's a doctor of veterinary medicine with the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. What questions do you have about being a veterinarian? How important is a good veterinarian to your family? Well, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Jill Nadeau for WPR News. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk about the state of Wisconsin fisheries with a panel of experts. And we'll also get the latest on land conservation trusts. That's starting tomorrow at 11 right here. But right now we're talking about the joys and challenges of being a veterinarian with our guest, Dr. Calico Schmidt. And we're going to go to the phones. We've got Beverly in Madison with a question. Go ahead, Beverly.
Yeah, good afternoon. I've always been curious why the vet medicine hasn't found a way to deal with its shortage of vets the way that human health care did. Because, you know, a long time ago, there were just med techs, nurses, and doctors. And then they put in the nurse practitioners and the physician's assistants for a high level of care, but not quite that of the doctor. But by saying that veterinary medicine is not dealing with its shortage of vets in this way at all. I'm curious why, or if that's maybe going to change.
Great. That's an excellent question, Beverly.
Thank you for that question, Beverly. I think it's very insightful, and I think we're going to see some changes in that area very soon. Colorado has just enacted a bill which basically allows for a veterinary equivalent of a veterinary nurse practitioner. And as you can imagine, there's been a little bit of controversy going back and forth because we also have our wonderful veterinary technicians, or we call them veterinary nurses, who go to school specifically to help in a similar capacity to what human nurses do. So I have a feeling that that may trickle across the United States so that we may have some mid-level practitioners as well. And I think another way that's been addressed, too, is that there are additional veterinary schools who are opening across the United States. I think in the last year, boy, I'm not going to know the number, but we have a number of new veterinary schools that are admitting people to try and help with this problem.
Because we are becoming so pet-centric in our lives that we really do need more. I mean, because sometimes you call and you can't get in unless it's an emergency for weeks.
Yeah, so that's been a really big concern that we're trying really hard to mitigate. So
absolutely,
we're working on it, Beverly. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a great idea. Hopefully that will take off. So we mentioned that, you know, you can specialize in dogs, cats, small animals. There's also or companion animals, as they call it. And then there's also big animals. So can you kind of tell us the difference, and what other categories can people specialize in?
Well, that's a beautiful question. And that's one of the really cool things about veterinary medicine, too, because I think a lot of students enter vet school knowing they want to do something with animals. And while you're in veterinary school, you don't have to know right away. You can choose based on what really interests you in school. So we have people who are interested in being that kind of James Harriet practitioner that we call a mixed animal practitioner, working with companion animals as well as large animals. And most of our students end up going into companion animal practice, working with dogs and cats. Some will add in some of the, we call them special species or exotics, like birds and lizards and snakes and rabbits and things like that. So that's one arm of veterinary practice. We have many practitioners, especially with our state being such a big dairy industry, who choose to go into food animal or production animal medicine, where they may work with dairy farms all day. And some of them, of course, work with other types of food-producing animals like swine or poultry. And then we have equine veterinarians who work with horses that are basically a big version of companion animals and also athletes. So there are equine practitioners. There are also opportunities in zoo animal medicine and working in wildlife or working in shelter animal medicine. And then we have people who are very interested in learning more about ways to help with both human and animal disease. So they pursue a job in veterinary research. We have veterinarians who go to school and earn a little extra degree in public health. So there are public health veterinarians who work to basically help prevent and treat diseases that are found in both animals and people. Like I'm sure you've heard of influenza, H5N1 influenza, and that can affect people as well as animals. So there are some specialized veterinarians who help in that field. There are veterinarians who go into industry and work with drug industries or food industries to help produce safe and effective drugs and foods for our animals and for people as well. Mm-hmm. So huge variety of things one can do. I'm sure I have missed some and I apologize for those that I have.
Yeah, well, there sounds like there's a lot of little niches for everybody to kind of fit in.
And some people even swap. I worked with a large animal practitioner in my very first job who worked mostly on dairy farms. And as he got older, you know, he started having some aches and pains, and he ended up, because he just could no longer do that physical job of being a large animal vet, he ended up working with companion animals. So you can swap mid-career, which is pretty cool.
Definitely. Justin in Wapaka emailed, he advises pre-veterinary students at the collegiate level, and he says that currently it is easier to be accepted into medical school than vet school. And he says if there is a great need for veterinarians, why not open vet schools to let more students with less than stellar transcripts and resumes?
Oh, that's a really packed question.
Yes,
thank you for
is.
That one. I think part of the challenge that we face there is that because we have only a limited number of veterinary schools and a limited number of spaces, we're a little bit restricted. And so while a large emphasis is grades that you receive, it's certainly not the only thing we look at. And we've relaxed some of those standards a little bit. Not that the students we admit are not stellar and wonderful, because they all are. And we also will look heavily at what other experiences those students have had. So it's kind of an interesting puzzle, and we're working on it.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you for that question, Justin. Appreciate that. How common is it for veterinarians to open their own practice?
That's a good question, too. I think that's becoming a little bit less common in today's world, because there are so many financial challenges that people face in owning their own business. I know there's a trend toward privately owned practices as those folks who run the practices become eligible for retirement. A lot of them end up selling their practice to a larger firm that manages multiple practices across the U.S.
Okay.
So I think it's becoming less and less common to own your own practice. But that being said, it's still a dream of many of our students, and it's still definitely attainable.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about, you know, money. Obviously, it's not cheap to go to any schools. I mean, medical schools, there's a lot of debt usually.
Yes.
Veterinarians don't make a lot of money. So, I mean, some do, obviously, but in general, they don't. So is there help for students who need that money to go to school?
There is some help, which is a good thing. Frustratingly, many of our students end up graduating with very large sums of debt. And that's one of the reasons as well that it's difficult for them to open a practice, especially right out of vet school, because they've got years to pay off debts ahead of them.
Mm-hmm.
Our school is lucky in that we offer a number of scholarships to people. So there's scholarship money available. There are also some federal programs, especially in the area of rural practice. So if students will go and agree to practice in a rural area, they can have some of their debt repaid or get help with repaying debts. Mm-hmm. So there are definitely some programs. We'd love to have more.
Definitely. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, 70% of veterinarians are women. Why do you think that that's happening like that?
Well, that's a really good question, too. And it's interesting to reflect on that, because when I went to veterinary school, which was a number of years ago, We were, I think there were still more men than women in our class, and that has definitely changed in recent years. And I don't know if there's one specific reason. I think there are a number of possibilities. One of them has finances as a root, and that is, as you noted, veterinarians don't make a ton of money. So there was one hypothesis that perhaps men were dissuaded from entering a veterinary medical career because they saw that they weren't able to make money, and so that opened up some places for women. I don't know how true that is. Certainly, I know that many women care for animals very deeply, and of course men do as well. So it's been a really interesting trend. Now I'd say more than 70% of our students are women.
That really is amazing, isn't it? Yeah. Especially when you think about large animal, because, you know, not to be stereotypical, but men tend to usually be stronger, bigger, can handle, you know, a big old cow. So
And that's really interesting, too. I remember when I was thinking about veterinary school, initially I was pondering being a mixed animal practitioner, and I'm not very tall in stature, and some people expressed concerns about that. But then I had others who told me, you know, you don't have to be a huge, really, really strong person, because we're very lucky these days to have drugs to help us sedate animals and help us manipulate them in ways that we need them to move.
That's
so
very
you don't
true.
Have to be a big bulky person. You can do it.
And you've got small hands, so you know.
That's right. There are advantages.
There absolutely are. So what are some of the things that have changed as far as schooling goes since you were in school?
Some of the changes I would say are related to, we now have the ability more so where we'll help students do what we call tracking, where they can choose and select at some schools right from day one, at some schools not until year two or year three of veterinary school, and it's a 4-year schooling program. But we allow students to choose an area of interest so that they can take courses that guide them more in that direction. So someone who's really interested in, for example, practicing with dairy cattle doesn't have to take all of their classes related to dogs and cats.
Sure.
Of course, everyone has to take those basic courses so they can pass the national exam.
Mm-hmm.
But we have much more availability for kind of specializing a little bit or choosing where you wish to go in veterinary school.
And what help do you have for people who, you know, first year of anything new is going to be a struggle, obviously, for some people. So how do you help first year, second year get through that?
Well, that's a really good question, because it does tend to be, I think one of the biggest difficulties is that there's just so much information to learn. So we try and help students understand that you can't know it all. We're going to try and teach you all that we can and give you a good scaffold on which to build additional knowledge, and then help you think about ways that you will be able to gain more knowledge and keep up your knowledge after you graduate. So how do you assess resources to know that they are scientifically evidence-based? And how do you think critically about cases? And how do you look things up if you aren't quite sure that you know the answer?
So more about how to rather than the spewing back of information. So what sources are there for people who, once they graduate, to keep up on all the things that are new, because that's changing so fast?
Oh, it is. I looked up a while back how short the time period is between when how long it takes for medical knowledge to double, and it's phenomenally short. So there's no way that you can know it all. So we try and give students an idea of, when you see, for example, a journal article or something on a website, how do you assess that to know whether that is something scientifically sound that you can believe? So some of the resources that we help students assess are different websites. There are great websites that are oriented towards specialties. For example, there's a Companion Animal Parasite Council that offers wonderful advice about parasites for dog and cat vets. And there are lots of really good practice guidelines put out by some nationally known veterinary organizations. So those are some things that we steer students toward. And then just help them think about, how do I find some of those resources that are going to grow and change as I'm in practice?
So a big part, I would assume, of being a vet is keeping up with all of the new changes.
Yes.
That takes a lot of time, too.
It does. And we have requirements. Every state has continuing education requirements. So we have to learn new things and keep up in order to stay licensed.
Oh, wonderful. Well, thank you for spending some of your valuable time with us today.
You're welcome.
We really appreciate appreciate that. Thank you to Dr. Calico Schmidt. She is a veterinary, a practicing veterinarian at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. And I'd like to thank my team of... Okay, I didn't write this. Doggone team of perfect staffers. Oh, Jeff, you're going to pay for that one. Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, and of course, our regular host, Larry Mueller. I'm executive producer Jill Nadeau. Stay tuned, lots more right here at WPR News.